You hear President Oaks the other day say what the Deseret News said about that production, greatest thing there's ever been in Utah? Well, I was all set to go to the Thursday one, I guess, and something came up. I didn't go, so I didn't get to hear that production. I would like to. But anyway, this man, Jerome Hines, this internationally famous, you call him bass or basso or bass or whatever it is, fish. Anyway, he's a great singer. He has a degree in chemistry from UCLA. They didn't even advertise that part on the program. I don't know what's the matter with him. So he's interested in chemistry and chemical things. He not only has a bachelor's degree in chemistry, he essentially had a master's degree, just some simple little thing he could have done, but he just didn't do to get a master's degree in chemistry from UCLA. But while he was working on his chem degree, he was singing in school operas and whatnot. And he was so good that the scouts picked him up. First thing he knew, he was out on the circuits, you know, making money as a singer and making so darn much money that he sort of left chemistry. But he didn't really leave his interest. Since he on tour, you're just doing nothing but traveling, you wouldn't be near a laboratory, so he decided to do theoretical chemistry. And to do theoretical chemistry, you have to become really good at mathematics. And so he studied all kinds of advanced mathematics while he's on tour. And he publishes papers in theoretical mathematics. In fact, he's written a book in the way out field of advanced theoretical stuff in mathematics. So when he came to campus, he came to see the chemistry department, and one of the things he wanted to see was diamonds being made. So I took Jerome Hines over to the lab with the chemistry department chairman, Elliot Butler, and we showed him all the equipment, how the thing worked in the cell you put your sample in and the whole bit. And he was very interested, and then we put it in the high pressure machine and ran it up to pressure and temperature, and we didn't make any diamonds. And that must be the first time in 1,000 runs when I've tried to make diamonds that we haven't made any. And he and Elliot Butler had another appointment, so they had to run off. And I was sort of embarrassed, to say the least.
Stay under the pressure?
Oh, we usually let it stay about 30 seconds is all. But most of the diamonds get made in the first 15 seconds of pressure and temperature. But loading the sample in a demonstration experiment, I could do it in about 1 minute. But, you know, demonstrate for somebody else, take about 5 minutes, and then the high-pressure machine we use is a research machine. It's not a commercial machine, and it moves slowly. We're not in production, so it takes that press 3 minutes to run up to pressure. Then you turn on the temperature. It takes about 5 to 10 seconds to heat up to about 1,650 degrees centigrade. And then you hold that for, up to 1 minute if you want to do the best job. Then you let the pressure off, which only takes 5 seconds or less, and you let the temperature off in less than 4 seconds, and then the press opens real slowly. The press is 6 years old and has its mechanical problems. It takes about 10 minutes for it to come open. But in a production press, it goes zap right in there with the anvils pressing on things, and things come on fast and it opens real fast. Complete cycle in an industrial machine. Oh, it's about 5 minutes. If you worked at it, you'd speed it up over that, but about 5 minutes. Let's see. Today,
sort the diamonds out of
the
stuff
afterward. What were we
going
to do?
How do you sort the diamonds out of it afterward?
Chemical process. We usually use an alloy of nickel as a catalyst. nickel, chromium, manganese alloy. All of the graphite does not turn to diamond. You can arrange the situation so you can turn around 90% to diamond. But then each individual tiny diamond is covered with a coating of the catalyst metal, which is very resistant to being dissolved away in acid. You have to use a very strong oxidizing acid to dissolve the metal away. Use aqua regia. And then to get rid of the excess graphite, you have to oxidize it with a mixture of concentrated sulfuric acid mixed with a nitrate, which is again a very oxidizing acid. But you'll have graphite, metal, it'll sort of be mixed up. So you have to keep alternating between the two acids. And to do a good job of cleaning up the diamond grit that's formed in an industrial diamond making process, you may take as long as a month. But you know, this is an ongoing thing, so you got 100,000 carats of diamond going through various stages of the process. So the longest part of the manufacture is getting rid of the catalyst metal and the graphite so that you have pure diamond remaining. Somewhere along the line, this thing has to be filled out, and I guess you've done this in honor classes before. And I have never taught an honors class before. So as I understand this, I'm to give this to a student. And it says don't do it in class, but I'm going to do it at the end of class. I want to quit. How long does it take to fill this out? You've done before, haven't you? 10 minutes, enough time? Okay, if I'm not paying attention, let's quit at 20 minutes to. And I'll leave, and then Cindy, will you be the monitor that does that? And then you have to take them back to honors program. It says in the letter. It's in the library office, I guess. Isn't that where their office is? And eventually I get some report back, like you do with the regular professor evaluation, that says the students love you, or you're going, or you're just average or below average, some comments like that.
Well, you know me, don't you?
What's that?
You know me, don't
you? Boy, love's the greatest thing in the world. That's what the kids sing about nowadays. The professor can have the students' love. He really is. I'm going to pass out something that I just had reprinted. It's personal experiences in high pressure that gives just a thumbnail bit about my synthesis of diamonds. This was the Chemical Pioneer address back in 1970 that I gave in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at a meeting of the American Institute of Chemists, at which they gave me an award. So pass those around. You can have one for yourself and one for your mom and dad or your boyfriend. Anyway, I've got lots of them, so don't take more than two. Question, Grace?
Junior high school science teacher told him some things about you. I
just wanted
me to ask if they were true.
Unlike George Washington, I cannot tell a lie.
Well, a Cummings teacher said that the government took your diamond patent away twice for defense purposes. Is that true?
Well, that's a German truth. And if we quit talking about chemistry and I tell you all about diamonds for the rest of the semester, maybe we can get to that. Maybe we can get to it quicker than that. Was that the only question, or were there some others?
That's just one more question.
Yeah. I've had some exciting times in my life when I could have well had a heart attack or my ulcers could have eaten me out, and that was one of the times. Let me try and tell you, I never have gotten down to when I synthesized diamonds at General Electric, have I? Well, let's tell you that today then. This is very brief, and I tried to be very kind to people in this article. Don't want any enemies. The General Electric people and I still love each other, but that's a... That's a public edition of what went on. It's the truth, but I could have said it in much stronger language. I think that we can go to the point where General Electric became interested in synthesizing diodes. That happened in 1937, and perhaps I already told you that General Electric joined hands with the Carborundum Company and with the Norton Company and financed Percy Bridgman with $100,000 in 1937 that he was to spend to try and synthesize diamond. The money had been spent by 1941 when World War II came and Professor Bridgman had not made diamonds. But he had done some interesting experiments that were valuable, and I may not have time to talk about those, but he did some good things, but he never synthesized diamond. Now, Professor Bridgman managed to get high pressures, not as high as I finally got, but up high enough to have done the job. But he could only do it in a very tiny volume. His volume would have been, in fact, that hole punched out of paper. That was his working volume. A thin, 5/1000ths of an inch thick disc, approximately 3/16ths of an inch across. He could not heat his samples. He never learned how to get pressure and temperature together at the same time. Now, once that job was finally done, you can see how simple it was, but men tried to do that for years and years. That's often the case. Once the job is done, everybody says, oh, hey, if I could have done that. And you could have, but it just seems to be hard to get over some simple bumps when you're trying to do something. Diamond research was essentially abandoned in this country during World War II for more important matters. But it was not abandoned in Germany. The Germans were effectively cut off from diamonds because of the supplies from South Africa, and South Africa was an allied nation in World War II, and they just could not get any diamonds out of there for German use. Now, diamonds are important to industry. You would have no industry without diamonds today. You'd be taking a step so backward that you just, well, you can't live without them. It's just part of things. You have to have diamonds. Well, the Germans had then a gigantic diamond-making project. I heard one man by the name of Lieb Hoschke, who was sent in. When the war was over, U.S. scientists and technicians were sent into Germany to see what they had. You know, they had the rockets, which we didn't have, and they were sending them over to drop them down on London. We didn't get to that part because the Russians got there first and stole the whole darn thing, you know. Well, I shouldn't say we didn't get there. We got in on it in part, but the Germans got the main part. They kidnapped the major scientists, and they took over most of the installations on the rocketry. Well, Lieb Hoschke was one of the men who went in, looking over what the Germans were doing. And one of the truly big things was trying to make diamond, and he compared the scope of that to the scope of our atomic bomb project. The Germans did not succeed. But they had tried all the other people's claims. And this has gone on several times in history. They tried Hannay, and they tried Moisson, and the other people who had tried to make diamonds without success, and they had no success of their own. A little bit of what was done during World War II appeared in the scientific literature that appeared in Germany, but not much. When the war was over, many companies again became interested, including General Electric. And in 1951, Chauncey Guy Suits, Vice President and Director of Research of the labs in Schenectady, New York, decided that they would go to work on diamonds. He'd been talking to Zay Jeffries of the Carbaloid Company. Now, did I pass out Carbaloid to show you this hard thing that only diamonds can grind? Didn't I do that the day I passed out the various kinds of diamonds? Yeah, that great big round thing. General Electric was the first manufacturer of that material in the United States, of carbaloid. The Germans invented it. General Electric bought the worldwide rights to that. And they got in trouble for doing that because in about 1932, 5 years after General Electric acquired the rights and started to manufacture this stuff, the U.S. government hit General Electric with an antitrust suit, a big one. The biggest one there'd ever been up to that time, over this issue of them having worldwide rights to this material. And back then, they were tough, because this, I wonder who had been in power then. This had been when Roosevelt came in, wouldn't it? Yeah. Very socialistic-minded attorney general and whatnot with him. And they really soaked it to General Electric and to their officers. The president of General Electric Company and at least a half a dozen top officers were fined, tremendous fines, over $1 million each. And I think some of them served jail sentences. And the company itself was fined a tremendous amount of money. And they had to give up the rights that they had bought to the German. And very quickly, there were approximately 20 tungsten carbide manufacturers came into being back around 1935 after this antitrust suit was settled against the General Electric Company. Well, Zay Jeffries was the vice president at Carbaloy. Carbaloy is the trade name of the cemented tungsten carbide that General Electric manufactures. And the manufacturing plant is in Detroit. And this Zay Jeffries had a great interest in synthesizing diamonds, and he was the guy who instigated the giving of the $100,000 to Bridgman. And then he, although he was retired in 1951, he was talking to Suits and telling Suits that he ought to go back to work on that problem. Well, the company decided they would spend approximately $1 million to work on this thing. And they picked two physicists to work on the problem in the beginning. One of the men's names was Francis Bundy. The other one was Herbert Strong. They were assigned to survey the literature and bring back a report on what had been done. This they did. And when they had completed this, I believe it was about November of 1951, the company people, Suits and others, looked at this report and said, well, let's begin. We've seen what's been done, so let's begin. But let's get some chemists on the program. There were approximately 30 chemists in the GE lab at that time, at least in the division of the chemistry area where I was located. And all of us were called into a meeting, told of this super secret project that General Electric was going to embark on, of trying to make diamonds from graphite, and they wanted two volunteers to work on the project. I was the only guy who volunteered, so I got the job. Now, there were reasons why no one volunteered, and there were reasons why I did. I had been interested in the problem before going to General Electric. I'd read about this thing as a kid, long before I ever went to college. And when I was working on my master's degree at the University of Utah, although I had an official project, I spent more time working on a project of learning about diamonds and trying to make them than I did on my official one. And my former professor at the time, G. Victor Beard, is always very interested in reminding me when he sees me of how we used to work on diamonds back at good old University of Utah. Well, the reason people didn't volunteer is that most scientists who would have a PhD in chemistry would have known of the long history, unsuccessful history of attempts, which includes something like 5 people who have obtained the Nobel Prize for work such as Moissan, he got for his furnace, and a guy named Crookes, and of course Bridgman, that's 3. There are at least 2 more who have worked on the problem without success. So it's like going to the horse races, you know, and playing the 100,000 to 1 shot, so to speak. Well, because of my prior interest, I liked the idea of a long shot. I need to tell you the situation after the war. During the war, many scientists were drafted. I had a master's degree in chemistry, and yet I was essentially drafted. I joined quickly before they did draft me. And this happened to most young men. I was 24 at the time. If you were between about 18 and 26, you were almost for sure in the service. I could have had an out. I didn't know about it, though, because I didn't know about the Atomic Energy Project. But at one point, somehow, Westinghouse had contacted me. I was working at the U.S. Bureau of Mines in Salt Lake City and working, well, I obtained my master's degree, and then at the same time I was working there, I worked nights and got my master's degree, and then I was just working there following a master's. That's as high as you could go at the University of Utah in those days. They didn't have a PhD program. But Westinghouse contacted me and said they had a project and I was qualified and they needed me. But they couldn't tell me about it by phone or letter, but to please come back at their expense and talk to them about it. And I told them no. But later on, I knew what it was. It was the Manhattan Project. And had I gone, then I would have never been a flunky in the Navy starting out at $8 a month when I was making $250 a month at the U.S. Bureau of Mines and had a wife and one kid. Had to send the whole $80, and they could hardly live on that, and I couldn't even buy an all-day sucker with what's left over. But after it's all over, it was all for the good. But you can have some pretty bad feelings. So many people in World War II. You know, the folks at home making money hand over fist, getting overtime pay and working all this, that, and the other, and the poor guys in the services getting $80 a month. You could feel pretty bad about that, especially if you've been pulled off in a good job. Well, anyway, after the war, there were many young men of average age, I would say around 26 years, who were being hired by companies all over the place. Every large company had discovered that science pays, and IBM, General Electric, Westinghouse, U.S. Steel, you name it, any big organization, decided to hire scientists and really go into the research business. And as a consequence, there were thousands of young men of that approximate age with PhDs that was hired. At the time I was hired, which was October of 1948, I'd say General Electric had probably acquired 500 young men my age, fresh from the war, and there to work on science, make money at scientific research. So that was the kind of situation, and all these guys were eager. Situation was different than before the war. They were older. See, before the war took 2 to 4 or 5 years out of a guy's life. And so the men were older. They were a little more mature, and they wanted to succeed. And I was the same. And success in science means writing scientific papers, publishing them in the various journals, and getting as many as you can. That's the major goal. Well, who wants to go in the field of making diamonds, you see? Let's do something where you're going to be able to publish papers right away. So that's why people didn't volunteer. And it was a secret project, and you knew you wouldn't be able to publish much anyway. Well, so I was on the project. Now, to get a second chemist, one more year went by, and then they hired a young graduate from the University of Wisconsin as their second chemist, and his name was Robert Wintour. The work was assigned out in two ways. There were two jobs that appeared necessary to be done. One was to invent equipment that could generate the high pressures and high temperatures. In the minds of management, this was the job for the physicists, so that was their assignment. Come up with equipment that could generate at least 35,000 atmospheres of pressure simultaneously with at least 1,000 degrees centigrade. Job for the two chemists was to figure out how nature did it or invent a way to do it. Take a carbon-containing compound, figure out what might be needed, apply all the thermodynamics and kinetics and everything else that you could to the problem to see what chemistry you would have to use once you had the high-pressure, high-temperature machinery. Well, now Bundy did take off from Bridgman's apparatus, which Bridgman called today it's called a Bridgman anvil press. Bundy modified the Bridgman anvil press in a way that Bridgman had done, but Bridgman had not been able to make work. Bundy could make it work. And Bundy right away got 35,000 atmospheres of pressure at 1,000 degrees centigrade. The goal, right off, he had, I think, within 6 months. The volume, however, was very tiny. But it's big enough volume in which to do some experiments. Well now, Strong and Bundy were old-time friends. They grew up together, went to school together, worked at MIT Radiation Lab during the war together. And they worked there with the boss, the vice president, Suit, so they were great friends with the boss. They started doing chemistry in their device until they tired of it, had no success, and then they let Wentorf and I use the device, and we used the device for a long time until we tired of it with no ideas that could do anything. Everything we tried did not work, even though scientists around the world would have thought these conditions would turn graphite to diamond. Well, the only way out was to try for still higher pressures. It was decided in the meeting, well, we must be wrong. Let's try to get apparatus to go to higher pressures. Now, Bridgman had a device that's called a two-stage device, different from his anvil device, that it looked like there was no way he could ever heat that device. But Strong and Bundy figured if they could scale this laboratory two-stage piston cylinder thing of Bridgman's up into gigantic scale, then there'd be some possibility of heating the inside. So, in talking things over in the various meetings, the management decided to go this way. This would be the approach to use. Now, this would cost money, because a special hydraulic press that had two hydraulic rams, concentric rams, an internal and external ram, would be required. External ram of 500 tons of thrust and internal 500 tons of thrust. This thing was five stories tall and cost $150,000, which in 1950, around that period, was quite a bit of money. As a matter of fact, the vice president for research could not spend for an equipment item more than $25,000 in those days. Gives you an idea that money was worth a lot more than now, without approval of the president of the company, who at that time was Wilson, or two Wilsons. President of General Motors was Charlie Wilson, and president of GE was, I forgot his name.
Were they related?
No. Oh, I got it wrong. I know. Their first names were Charlie. It was Auto Charlie and Electric Charlie. The last names were different. Charlie, I forgot. Well, a permission was obtained to go this route. Now, you have to understand the politics of any organization. When you commit a large amount of money to a way you're going to do something, boy, you're going to see that it gets done that way, even if you have to lie about it. And that's what actually happened in this case. Now, see, all the way up the chain of command, here was the commitment. We get the $150,000 press, we go into this kind of thing, and this is how we're going to get these higher pressures. Well, I didn't want to wait, because this was a year and a half or 2 years down the road for this machine to be built. And I had ideas as to how to build a machine, but it was not my calling or my assignment to dabble in the high pressure apparatus. My assignment was the chemistry. Well, I did have a good idea though, as to a device which they allowed me to build. But Bundy, who was sort of the man in charge of the apparatus then, with his sidekick Strong, was assigned to evaluate my apparatus after it was built. And he told him it wasn't any good. But it was. It was a good device. And I knew it was a good device. Now, I don't know what words to use, but I felt bad about it, but I didn't ever feel animosity towards the guy for it. He's a good Christian gentleman. I think he believed what he said. But I believe he had a bias because of what I try to describe as the political situation. After all, you see, I was not really assigned in that area. He was the guy to make good in that area. He had convinced his boss, had convinced the vice president to spend the $150,000 and so on and so forth. My device didn't cost anything like that. We already had a standard hydraulic press. This thing cost less than $1,000 to put in there, and it worked, made out of hardened steel. I figured I was getting pressures in the hardened steel device somewhere around 55,000 atmospheres. I probably was. Today, we know I was probably getting 10 kilobars less. K kilobar is the same as 1,000 atmospheres. It's probably getting 45,000 atmospheres. But I no sooner had this plan started and working in the shop than I knew how to improve it. And this is often the case in scientific work and design. You just get this thing going and, oh, a new idea. I know how to improve it, and it's not even built yet. But they would not let me build the improved version. They just would not give me a shop order to do it. Well, I really had ulcers about that because I was convinced that I had the way to do it. I knew how to do it. Wouldn't take this $150,000 press. So I sneaked it done, did it sub rosa. I went down to the shop. I knew the guys pretty well. I said, now look, I don't have a shop order to work on this, but you guys are loafing around a lot. How about just doing me a favor and building it when you don't have anything else to do? And they did. Now it took 6 months that way. They could have done it mighty soon if they had. Well, the first device didn't have a name at the time, but we called it the half belt later on. The invention I had was the full belt, or just plain belt, in hardened steel. And it worked, had a tremendous volume, 1,000 times the volume of Bundy's device, or even greater volume over that that Bridgman had. And certainly it could get pressures of 45,000 atmospheres, no doubt at all about that, and temperatures anything you wanted, up to 7,000 degrees centigrade for milliseconds, 3,000 degrees centigrade for 3 minutes. And the thing to do to improve the device now is to build it out of tungsten carbide, the carbolol. Now that's something I couldn't do sub rosa. That had to be made in Detroit. And I guess we better quit and go on to that other business, so...
We have 10 more minutes.
Huh?
It is at 3 o'clock.
Oh, we quit at 3, don't we? We're in the afternoon. All right, we can go to 10-2, is that right?
Right.
All right. Well, that's where they'd end it on TV.
Right. Tune in next time.
Well, I have to take a slight detour now to tell you of another situation. When I first went to work at General Electric, my boss was Abraham Lincoln Marshall, and he wanted to be called by his full name. And he was the boss over chemistry and over a peculiar division that was in chemistry known as the mechanical investigations section, which just historically had come into the chemistry department because of the work on gas turbines, which jet engines and things, which do require chemistry. Then my second boss was Liebhofsky. He was the guy I said, he was a General Electric man. He's the guy who went into Germany on the team to see what the Germans had done. Hermann Liebhofsky. A guy who didn't smoke, never carried his own cigarettes, he just borrowed them off and all the other guys. It was really funny, guys used to get so mad at him. He was always quitting smoking. In fact, he always claimed he didn't smoke, but then he'd always have to have a smoke 4 or 5 times a day and always borrow somebody else's cigarettes day after day. I liked him just the same. Yeah, I guess all of us are peculiar in some ways. That was a very notable peculiarity of Hermann. Then, when the Diamond Project came into being, they actually put it in the mechanical investigations section. But Liebhofsky sort of considered that I was on loan to them, and the boss of mechanical investigations, who was a guy by the name of Tony Nierad, figured that I was his employee. So I had a kind of a split situation, not knowing who my boss was. But since my own boss, I sort of thought Tony really is the boss, but Liebhofsky hadn't really let go of me all the way. Since Tony would not let me build this thing or give me the $1,000 it would cost to build it in tungsten carbide, and since my buddies and all the way up the ladder figured that my apparatus wasn't any good, I figured, well, if it's not any good, see, this is secret, not supposed to tell anybody else about it. But if it's not any good, and they say it's not any good, heck, I'm going to tell other people about it. Now, various sections in chemistry would hold their own seminars, and Lee Posky had his own seminar. We held it in what's called the guest house in the evening. So I talked to Herman, and I says, let me speak to your group and tell them about my apparatus that my own people don't think is any good. And he agreed. And so that night, my first major talk, I guess, that I'd ever given. I prepared well and looked up a good joke. And when I think of that joke now, it was really terrible. Oh, you've heard this. I don't know how you get it off. So, you know, a joke can be really lousy, but if you're Bob Hope, you can get it across. It was this stupid joke about some dog coming into a... Let's see, there was a dog in a gas station, and the guy spilled some gas, and the dog lapped it up, and he started running around like crazy, and he flopped over, and then you quit at that point and wait for somebody in the audience to say, was he dead, which they'll always do, and you say, no, he's just out of gas. They laughed at it that night. I must have told them. My wife really groans over that joke. But anyway, I converted that whole crowd of some dozen or so chemists, including Lee Posky, that I really had a good device. And that, well, I showed them all the mathematics of it. It was something I had dreamed up and had figured out all the angles on and had all the stuff there to support my cause. And Lee Posky was converted, so he just goes up the ladder and tells them they're a bunch of crazy louts. Give me the tungsten carbide, let me build it. And they did. But see, a lot of valuable time was wasted. Well, when I got it in tungsten carbide, and as I fooled with it, I went into pressure territory where no one else had been. So I had to devise schemes trying to measure where I was, and this I did, and I figured that I had reached pressures of 200,000 atmospheres, twice what Bridgman had ever been to, and I could heat mine, and Bridgman couldn't. But as we now know, I was at a much lower pressure. I was only at 140,000 atmospheres, but that was still, you see, way beyond what had been done before. See, Bundy had got to 35,000 atmospheres with heat in a small volume. I had a large volume at 140,000 atmospheres. Now, time went on. I think it was about a year that I was able to get these conditions, and I could not convert graphite to diamond, and neither could Wentorf. Wentorf and I kept using that apparatus. Now, Strong and Bundy built they wanted to improve on the belt, and they built various versions of it and continued to work, and they never succeeded either, and none of the so-called improvements were ever as good as the original belt. The belt to this day, used by G, is the same as I designed it back in not sure when I designed it. Might have been 52, late 52, I guess. Well, all right. In the first part of December of 1954, I had written a paper on the belt apparatus, and I had written a paper on the melting point of germanium as a function of pressure to about 140,000 atmospheres. I may have been claiming 200,000 atmospheres in those days. The pressure I went to was just short of 140,000, we now know. Now, this was fantastic to make a measurement like that, just way beyond scientists' imagination, something they would love to do but would never dream that it'd be possible to do things like that. So I was anxious to publish these two papers, and I had approval on it. here I was going to start becoming famous like all us young bucks wanted to be. See, publish these papers. But then on December 16th, I made the biggest mistake of my life. I made Dinah, and those papers were not allowed to be published for a long, long time. Now, what I did that was different on that day was that I was reading, I had read before. As a matter of fact, I'd done experiments along this line clear back in 1951, but they hadn't worked then, so why try them again? There had been three meteorites come to Earth which contained tiny diamonds, a source now, you see, other than the diamonds of South Africa. And in reading the literature about those, I learned that these microscopic diamonds had a film of the mineral troilite, FES, surrounding each tiny microscopic crystal of diamond. So I put troilite in with the graphite. I used the graphite for its own heater. You see, graphite will conduct electricity, so I would heat it by passing electricity through it. Now, it's my habit to use a variac, which regulates voltage, increase the voltage across the sample, and you'd have 2 meters, an ammeter and a voltmeter. And as you'd increase the voltage, both of these meters would rise. And I'd get up to some temperature, which I had to estimate in a real crude way. But on this day, I happened to notice that the ammeter faltered a little bit, and this faltered a little bit, and then this fell back a little, and the voltmeter advanced a little. And the thought instantly went through my mind, that could happen if diamonds were being made. My sample contained a core of the troilite, and the outside was graphite, and electricity was passing through that graphite. There was a tantalum disc up here, it has a high melting point, and a tantalum disc down here, just so it would melt. Electricity coming through the disc and running down through here. If some of the graphite's turning the diamond, it would impede the flow of current. Diamonds are electrical insulators. When they're real hot, and you see in there, they'd be at 1600 degrees centigrade, hotter than required to melt steel. But still, they would not conduct like graphite. So I stopped at that point, and I let it sit for a little while. And this continued to slowly sink and this to rise. And then, when I broke the cell open, and I'll try and show that to you in some slides later on, I broke it open and looked at it just like that. And I saw diamonds with my naked eye. It didn't even need a magnifying glass. And I'd seen enough diamonds, I'd know a diamond when I saw it. My hand just began to tremble like that, and my heart would stop, and then it would run 200 beats a minute, and I just couldn't stand up. I had to sit down, but because I knew at that instant, just no doubt in my mind, that diamonds had finally been made by man. Now, I repeated the experiment, and it was not always successful, but I could make diamonds at least 50% of the time. And I immediately began a search to find the exact pressure and exact temperature bounds. What are the bounds of temperature and of pressure where you can make the diamonds? Jeff?
How soon has we told anybody about it?
Not for a few days.
That was hard.
So I made the chemical tests that are necessary. I burned the little diamonds in oxygen just as Lavoisier had done. I got carbon dioxide. Good test. I scratched hard substances like sapphire and boron carbide. My crystal scratched those hard things. I examined the morphology of the crystals on the microscope, just like you see on diamonds, no doubt about it. And I performed certain other tests. I tried to get density and refractive index, which I could not get good values on. But they were in the ballpark, certainly did not indicate there wasn't diamond. Then the following Monday, I think it was a Thursday when I first made them, I had an X-ray diffraction made, and clearly the thumbprint of diamond was there. And it was at that point that I told the guys, and yes, well, yeah, so what? There had been instances of, I thought I'd made diamonds once before, and the other guys had thought they had made them before too. In fact, one of the guys still would claim that he was the first to make diamond, but he nor no one else had ever been able to duplicate what he had done. Now, actually, I believe it was 20 days went by before the other guys became interested. There was a funny situation. Really, we were waiting for the big press, and we were all working on other projects. My official assignment was working on a dehumidifier for basements, a control form. Wentorf was on vacation when I made diamonds, and Bundy was in Building 37, 3 miles away, working on turbine bearings. And Strong was working on vacuum insulation refrigerator. So none of us were really, in theory, working on a project. So there wasn't much interest. Well, now, a Jewish friend of mine who was, so we do that report tomorrow.
Yeah.
Actually, it tells you to pass it out to him and do it at home. Maybe we can do it that way. Well, you got to have somebody else duplicate it. Well, my Jewish friend I was with in the lab all the years from the very day I landed there, named Ed Brady, had him come down lunch hour and go through the process. He didn't make them. Well, I had not always made them myself. So the thing to do is come down some other lunch hour. Now, I was the first Mormon to ever work for the General Electric Research Laboratory. Lots of engineers had worked out in the company in various places. But I was the first Latter-day Saint they hired. And there was prejudice in that lab against us Mormons. I don't know exactly why. The boss, Abraham Lincoln Marshall, used to tell the foulest Mormon jokes you can imagine in my presence all the time that make me squirm. Anyway, there had recently come to the lab a young PhD physicist by the name of Hugh Woodbury, who was a Latter-day Saint, a graduate from Caltech. So one noon hour I decided, well, I'll let Hugh, he's from another area anyway, he's not a chemist, he's a physicist, I'll let him do it. So he made them, 31st of December 1954. So the first guy to make diamonds was a Mormon, and the second guy to make diamonds confirmed the first guy was a Mormon. And that diamond that he made was preserved. I suppose it's still there as the first duplication, you know, of another guy's work. But it was not an official thing, so the company decided, well, things started to stir and guys began to think, well, yeah, maybe something's here, and it gained momentum, you know. And finally, it started to gain its momentum in the first weeks after the new year. And finally, the president of the company himself was in my lab looking through my microscope.